Good day, and welcome to Blooming Basics for ZVM and Linux on System Z Part 1 teleconference. This call is being recorded. To access today's materials, please check your calendar invitation or go to SSI Business Partners. Please check Partner World. The presentation materials, transcript, and audio file on today's call will remain on the website for 6 months. Now I'd like to turn the call over to Julie Leisenveld. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thanks, John. And again, welcome everyone, and thank you for joining us on our first day of our Blooming Basics. Pam, Christina, and I will be your hosts the next 3 days. The way each day will work is we'll have three topics each day that you can pick and choose from. Each will run about 55 minutes with a five-minute break in between. As John said, we are recording each presentation, and so there will be individual MP3s for each session available and will be posted next week on SSI Partner World and on the ZVM T3 website. If you can't get a, you know, if you can't get to the presentations, please send me a quick email or same time and I'll be glad to get you the links. It's Julie V, as in Virginia, at us.ibm.com. Our first topic today is Introduction to Virtualization, ZVM Basic Concepts and Terms. Bruce, our speaker, will be taking questions at the end of the session, so please jot them down while he's presenting. Bruce, please go ahead.
All right. Thank you, Julie. And Julie gave you the topic, and I hope you have the presentation. I will be giving you the page numbers I'm on as I go through. But my name is Bruce Hayden. I'm with the Advanced Technical Skills Organization, part of the Sales and Distribution Organization. I do sit here in Endicott, New York, where VM development is. I just get to be downstairs, and they're upstairs. But that's where I am. So anyway, moving on with the presentation, we can, of course, skip the trademark page. Page 3 gives some credits, and I do want to give credit to those who really created this presentation. It's not one that I created personally. It's been presented at SHARE by Bill Bittner several times. It's been presented at the System Z University, as it's called now, the Tech Conference by Brian Wade. So let you see the list of people that have really helped with this presentation. Page 4 is the introduction. We'll just talk about those subjects as we go through this presentation, some very basic concepts, some terminology, because we certainly use some different terminology on mainframes, and that can be very confusing to people who don't quite know what we're talking about sometimes. We'll talk about how ZVM virtualizes a System Z machine and what some of those concepts are in those that technology. And sometimes we'll compare this with what an LPAR is in a System Z machine or how Linux does things. So that's all part of the presentation today. So on page 5, we start to talk about why even use ZVM. I guess this is my marketing part of this presentation, if you will. But certainly virtualization is very big, not just on the mainframe. We certainly have the history there, but it's very big on really all platforms, all hardware platforms. It helps you simplify your infrastructures, you know, consolidate servers, consolidate networks and things like that. The reason we really are excited about virtualization on the mainframe is because mainframes just have a very well-known quality of service, very well-known availability, very well-known bandwidth for I/O and things like that. And so you really get those qualities when you virtualize on the mainframe. ZVM, which we're going to talk about here, has built-in system management. ZVM has evolved over a lot of years, and so we have all of those things going for us. And when you virtualize, you really help your speed of deployment or speed to market. We can create servers very quickly to meet needs, to try things, to experiment, to test. It's really rather amazing compared to building out real hardware. Installing servers, ordering servers, the whole deal. The other really dramatic thing you can do with the mainframe is you can allocate more capacity on the fly when needed. If you discover that your system needs more processors, more memory, things like that, the mainframe lets us, the technology there in System Z lets us do that usually on the fly without stopping things, stopping production, interesting things like that. So Linux running with ZVM really has a lot of function that because we're running on the mainframe and ZVM, then we get with just running Linux in other environments. They've improved Linux over the years. The IBM developers of Linux that developed the mainframe architecture part of Linux exploit a lot of the ZVM technology features that we have there. It really lets you build some very innovative solutions. So moving on to page 6, we're going to start to talk about some terminology and background. So page 7 starts that. Every computer system, no matter what it is, has some kind of an architecture. They have to build the hardware to some definition. And so what that is really the functional specification of how that hardware is supposed to operate. So it's a formal document. If you're writing software that runs right on that hardware, so we typically call those operating systems, of course, you want to know what that software can expect from the hardware. And so that's the architecture. And one point there is that architectures define what the computer system does, not really specifically how it does it. How it does it is up to the people that implement the real machines, and they can change their mind on how it does it. They can find better ways to do it, but they have to implement that architecture. So when we talk about an architecture, that's what we're talking about. IBM publishes the architecture of System Z and something called the Z Architecture Principles of Operation. It's a rather thick book if you saw a physical, a printed copy these days, because the mainframe has been around a while and it has evolved. But in that document, you'll find out what the instruction set is, the opcodes, the hex codes that make up the machine instructions, what they are, how they interact with the features of the processor, like the registers, the timers. You find out how interrupts are handled, how they're presented, how they're, cleared, the whole deal. You find out how you access memory and how it's arranged. And, of course, you need to know how you do I.O. You got to do some I.O. to some other devices to obviously get work done. So different models of a computer system, though, will implement the architecture different ways. A model could define how many processors are actually available. That model may only have, 24 processors. Another model may have 36. So, the number of processors is model dependent. How do the processors work with the memory? And as part of that, how the cache, which is always there in between the processors and memory, how that's arranged, how big it is, how it works, that kind of stuff. So that's what the different models do. Now, in System Z, we really have a limited list of models that actually implement the 64-bit System Z architecture, and you see that list at the bottom of page 7. Any future models that come along will implement the System Z architecture, and we can add on to that list. So moving on to page 8, IBM has had virtualization technology on the mainframe for quite a while, and you can see the bottom of that chart, the timeline of when virtualization started on the mainframe. It basically started very close to the time when the mainframe itself, the current line of mainframe starting with the System 360 started back in the 60s. And so as the mainframe architecture and technology has evolved, and you can see that in the bottom, System 360, System 370, on up the line to ESA and 64-bit, ZVM has evolved to be able to use those features. They made functional enhancements to support the machine, but they've also made enhancements in the performance and the scalability of ZVM, the flexibility and the robustness, all of those kind of things. So we've had virtualization on the mainframe for, as you can see, quite a while. We have a lot of history there. So moving on to page 9, there's a lot of, as I said, a lot of terminology we use for the mainframe that's different than what they use for distributed servers. So like Intel System P servers. And this simple table just kind of gives you the comparison there of some of them, and we'll hit some more later. But in the other world, we frequently talk about memory, where you store things. In System Z and in mainframes, it was always storage. I was always told back when the mainframes were invented, they didn't want to give them a human element, so they didn't use human terms for these parts of it. So it became storage. We use memory a lot, the term memory a lot these days, just to be consistent, but you'll still see the word storage in a lot of places. Of course, on the Intel and other architectures, you see disk or storage for, disk devices where you actually permanently store data. We certainly use those terms today more and more often on the mainframe, but you'll also see the term DASD, which stands for Direct Access Storage Device, that acronym. So that basically means disk or storage. For processors on System Z, we use processor or CPU. Those are pretty common terms, but frequently you hear the word engine, like a standard engine or something like that. And then we have all these types of CPUs that we will talk about. So we do have specialty processor types on System Z, like an IFL, Integrated Facility for Linux, one that you can run Linux workloads on. Down there on the list is CP or PU, Central Processor or Processing Unit. Those are CPUs that can really run any workload. The other ones on that list, IOP, SAP, Zips and Zaps, as you've heard of maybe, those are specialty processors to run special workloads or to do system assist kind of things or IO things that you can see in that list. And while a smaller system may call something a computer or a server or a system, a lot of times in the mainframe you'll hear the term CEC or Central Electronics Complex. That really means, that's kind of an engineering term that is the way I've always heard it, but it really means the actual physical box and everything in it. So we may call that a CEC, or you may call it a server or something like that. So that's some of the funny terminology, I'll call it, that we use sometimes. So what are virtual machines? I'm now on page 11. To give it the precise definition, which is a little confusing, but it says there in the middle of the page, a virtual machine is an execution context that obeys the architecture. Okay, what's that? Well, an execution context is anytime you run a program of any kind, there's a defined execution context to run that program in, you know, what the program may do, what it expects, what it may call. In this case, the execution context is that principles of operation, you know, what defines what a System Z computer is. That's the execution context. And so a virtual machine lets you execute a program, which is, you know, something, in this case, the program would be an operating system, that obeys the architecture. It can do I/O, it can work with memory, it can work with the registers that the architecture defines. So that's really what it is. ZVM, which you know we're talking about here as many parts, one of the parts we're going to talk about a lot is the ZVM control program, or CP. And you'll see that up in that blue line that's underneath all the virtual machines. That's what's creating the virtual machines. It's also very typically called a hypervisor because it is something in between the real hardware and the operating system that you're really running in your virtual machine. So it's a supervisor, but it sort of acts like it's not there in some respects because you're running in a virtual machine. So virtual machines have to faithfully replicate that principles of operation. They have to let you configure their virtual machine really any way you can configure a real machine. So you can try things out or test or just create a virtual machine the way you want it to, you know, need it to be. That also lets you create or execute virtual machines simultaneously. Basically, they appear to be running all at the same time, even though we know that there's time slicing and things going on. ZVM and CP can actually allow overcommitment of the real hardware. So they allow you to share processors between virtual machines. You don't have to have one real processor for every virtual machine, or very typically sharing memory, of course. And how much overcommitment you could do depends on how much hardware you have, the size of everything. At the bottom of that page, it also shows that a virtual machine is known as many different things, a VM user ID, a VM logon, a VM guest, or a virtual server. I think you see that term VM guest more and more these days. So in practice, on page 12, you can see we can run a whole bunch of different kinds of operating systems in virtual machines. So those operating systems on the top are the various operating systems IBM has or works on that run in virtual machines. And ZVM's control program is the one that manages that. You notice it says manages virtual machines that adhere to 390 and Z architecture, because Z architecture actually includes the older 31-bit addressing 390 architecture. You can actually run either architecture virtual machine in ZVM on System Z. There's also extensions available through CP System Services and Features. We'll talk more about those later. And there's a special single user operating system part of ZVM called CMS that's used to help operate the machine and service the whole ZVM system. I know in the next presentation, Brian will talk a lot more about CMS, so I'm not going to spend really any time on that. And you interact with the the control program running in a virtual machine through a console device, an I/O device, you know, like a screen basically, with a keyboard, all that kind of stuff. So there's, moving on to the next page, page 13, there's, I already introduced some of these terminologies. There's even more terms that we want to get you to know about virtual machines. I already mentioned a VM guest or just a guest. So that's a system that's operating in a virtual machine. Okay. Another very typical couple of terms when you're running an operating system in a virtual machine is calling running under VM or running on VM. They really mean the same thing. Just a matter of how you want to look at it. Then there's this term running second level. So what's that? Well, that, as it says there, you're running a system as a guest of VM, which is itself a guest of another VM. ZVM virtualizes the System Z hardware so well that you can actually run ZVM itself in a virtual machine. Okay, there's not a restriction there. You can do it. It runs just fine. Obviously, there's limits on how much you can do in there because there is more work going on to do that, but you can do it. So when you do that, that means that that VM running as a guest of VM is called a second-level VM system, and that's running second level. You can certainly have multiple virtual processors, just like real hardware can have real processors in a virtual machine, and you can share things in between virtual machines. We'll see some examples of that, and it's rather important in ZVM. If you looked at LPARs in System Z, there's some differences there, and this is just showing some of those differences. LPAR is provided by the hardware as we see it. There isn't an operating system you start up, although there is one that manages it. But a logical partition is the LPAR equivalent of a virtual machine. Logical partitions have logical processors. Virtual machines have virtual processors. And you'll also see the term running native or running in basic mode. And in modern machines, the machines out that you can buy today, you don't have a choice. Everything runs in an LPAR. But previously, we could actually choose to run the machine either without the LPAR code running, and that was called running in basic mode. That means we could only run one operating system on that hardware. Of course, if you ran ZVM, you could run multiple virtual machines. But LPARs, one of their design points is you have to be able to isolate things very well. So that's an important design point to LPAR. The next page, 14, actually kind of gives you a little picture here of the layers, if you will, and the processors. So LPAR provides logical processors, these LPUs. ZVM, on top of that, that's what it sees as its, quote, real processors. So ZVM executes virtual machines on the logical processors. ZVM provides virtual CPUs or virtual processors to its guests. It's guest machines, so like ZOS has one virtual CPU and Linux has one virtual CPU. And ZVM running on top of ZVM, that's a second level ZVM, has two virtual CPUs, and it provides a virtual CPU to a Linux server running on top of it. So you can see that where you get the first and second level and what the difference between a logical CPU and a virtual CPU is there. So page 15, let's start to talk about what a virtual machine really is. When you want to create a virtual machine, you can create it in any configuration that a real System Z could have. So you could come up with a list that I want, you know, a half a gig of memory, two processors, some I/O devices, and you can create a virtual machine that agrees with that. You know, what we're trying to say here all along through all of this is we completely implement the System Z architecture and what's defined in the principles of operation. So you really can't talk about a standard virtual machine because they're, you know, real machines can take on so many different configurations, and you may have a need to do that. So how do you define a virtual machine really in CP? Well, page 16 shows what a virtual machine definition looks like in the user directory. The user directory is a text file that we put in the definitions for virtual machines, and then that file is actually compiled into a binary format for CP to use, but this is what it looks like. You define the user, we give it a name. This is Linux 01. You give it how much memory by default you want it to have, in this case 512 megabytes. You tell it how many processors you want it to have and what architecture it is. Remember, ESA and Z architecture are really, Z architecture is a superset of ESA, so that means you can run either one in this machine. You define a number of I/O devices. And so we're defining spool devices, which we'll talk a little about later, network devices, which we also talk about later, and disk devices. So we'll get into what C some of these devices are, a little bit how they work later. But this is basically what it looks like to define a virtual machine. I know later on, again, the presentations that follow me on more details will talk a lot more about this user directory entry in some of these devices. And we also have CP commands. Remember I said that to interact with the control program, you use a console, a terminal device. And, of course, on that, you enter commands. It's kind of a line mode type interface. And so we have a lot of CP commands to control our virtual machine and the real machine. In this case, we're showing things that change our virtual configuration after we've started up our virtual machine. And that's a very normal thing to do. So the CP define command can add to the virtual configuration. The CP attach command can actually give an entire real device to a virtual machine, so I have exclusive use of it. So, you know, that's two different ways to get some devices added to your virtual machine. If I'm done with something, I can detach it. And then there's the CP link command, which we saw in the directory entry also. That lets a disk device owned by another virtual machine be used by my virtual machine, the one I'm issuing the CP link command to. So that's an example of sharing or just using some other resource. And there's a whole lot of set commands to change the various characteristics of our virtual machine if we need to do that. There is a interrupt architecture and all that, so that if you do change the configuration of your virtual machine, it can actually notify the guest operating system so we can react to that. So how do we get started? If you had a real machine sitting there and you wanted to turn on the power and get it going and run an operating system, what would you do? Well, you start out with the IML function, the initial machine load. Basically, you load the microcode into it and get it configured. In VM, how do you start a virtual machine? Well, you actually log on to CP using the logon command, give it a password, all that. It uses the machine statement to set the right architecture, and it creates the virtual machine. If you were starting up an LPAR, you would use the LPAR image activation part in the HMC. So that's how you get things created, kind of the empty container to run something in. So how do you load your operating system? Well, it's called the IPL, or initial program load function. This is basically the bootstrapping process, or like booting a Linux system. So in ZVM, if you wanted to start an operating system in your virtual machine, we give you a CP command called IPL, thankfully, that lets you start your virtual machine operating system up, or it can happen automatically as defined in your directory entry. If you were starting like CP itself or CMS, we typically call that you're loading the CP or CMS nucleus. That's just a term on the mainframe they've used instead of like a kernel, a Linux kernel, but they really mean the same thing. If you're starting up an operating system in an LPAR, you would use the load function to do that. So on to page 19, processors, and of course page 20. Processors on System Z, if you looked in the architecture, you would find out that you can have either up to 64 processors defined in the System Z architecture. So a virtual machine can have 1 to 64 processors. You define them in the user directory, so if you want them there by default, or there are commands to do that, to create processors and detach processors as you need to. We saw that list of processors, and there were several specialty types. You can create most of those specialty types, not necessarily I/O processors, in a virtual machine. You can also dedicate a real processor to a virtual machine if you have some need to do that, though it's not done very often. And throughout this, we have ways to control and limit the consumption, the use of processors. There's a scheduler in VM, and it decides, you know, how much resources your virtual machine is supposed to use. One way that it knows what the system programmer wants that virtual machine to have is something called a share setting, and that's how it prioritizes the consumption. We have choices on shares. We can have absolute or relative. So if I want to give you absolutely 10% of the real machine, I can do that. Or if I just want to give you twice as much as this other virtual machine, I can do that. That's called a relative share. And there are minimum and maximums in there, too. So we can try to make sure you have at least this much, but not that much, not over a certain amount. And we can even set a hard upper limit so that you can't go over that if that's what the requirement is. if you have multiple virtual processors in your virtual machine, then it just divides that share up between all the virtual processors. Another facility we have in System Z is something called SIE, or Start Interpretive Execution. This is actually a facility that's in the hardware of the machine, but it's also a machine instruction to access that facility. And that's what ZVM uses to run a virtual machine. When they designed the XA architecture back in the late 70s, we already were doing virtualization on the mainframe, and so they decided to actually put a lot of the basic function needed to run a virtual machine right into the hardware, and they put it in the SIE instruction. And later on, when they did LPARs, they decided to use that same hardware and facilities to run logical partitions. So the SIE instruction and the SIE facility is very important to running virtual machines. To run a virtual machine, we need to know the state of the virtual machine, so the virtual processor state and all that. That's all in a control block. And we need to know how memory is addressed. So we need to know about the dynamic address translation of memory addresses. So SIE has access to all that. Of course, SIE can't do everything. They couldn't put everything in the hardware. So if certain things happen, and you can see the list there, ZVM gets control back from SIE to actually do those tasks, like do an I/O operation or execute a privileged instruction. And there's also other communications methods between CP and SIE to, if CP needs to interrupt SIE doing something to reflect an interrupt or something like that. So this is a very key part of the System Z and ZVM, that we have the SIE facility to run our virtual machines, and we run them very effectively. We also have scheduling and dispatching. In VM, there's something called the scheduler, which decides, kind of makes a list of what virtual processors should be run in what order, things like that. And we have the dispatcher to actually run virtual processors on real processors. And, of course, you know, you get a time slice. You get a small amount of time you get to run before somebody else gets to run. So that's called your minor time slice. Interestingly, the dispatcher in ZVM doesn't just let you run for one time and just throw you out of the list. It leaves you there and lets you run and compete for time up to your elapsed time slice. So you get to stay in the dispatch list for a while and get some work done. It's a whole big subject on how all that really works for another topic sometime. The LPAR hypervisor uses something called wait settings and not share settings, but it's very similar to kind of what's going on. And, of course, Linux has its own scheduler to do its own time slicing too. So not uncommon, you know, multi-user operating systems have these scheduling and dispatching algorithms. Let's move on to memory, which, of course, we typically a lot of times call storage. So the configuration of your virtual machine memory is defined in the CP directory entry, or you can change it with a CP command. You can make it bigger or smaller if you would want to. There's even a facility that if you want to leave some gaps in your storage, so you have portions of your memory that don't even exist, you can do that. It's good for testing, as it says there. There's also a type of memory called expanded storage as part of the System Z architecture. What we generally think of as memory or storage is what we tend to call central storage or central memory. And there's something called expanded storage, which we'll see later as part of the paging hierarchy for ZVM. You can actually attach real expanded storage to a virtual machine if a virtual machine would need to have access to expanded storage. ZVM does not simulate expanded storage in real storage. So that's how you can have expanded storage. And there are certainly controls and limits on the use of memory, of course, because that's, you know, usually something that maybe you don't have enough of to run all your virtual machines. So the scheduler will select them because it knows how much memory they need. If there's not enough memory available to run a virtual machine, it may be put in a special list called the eligible list, meaning it's basically waiting for memory resources to be available to run. And there's other controls to reserve so much real storage for a virtual machine, or locking specific guest pages if you would need to do that for performance reasons. That's certainly available. Next page, 25, shows how we can share memory, or we have the ability to share memory. So I have three virtual machines. You'll notice they're different sizes. They have different memory sizes. but I have a shared address range that actually is part of the memory of all three virtual machines. You notice it can either be above the top memory of the virtual machine with a gap or even within that virtual machine's memory range. It's really up to the operating system running in that virtual machine if it can put up with having the shared memory right in the middle of the read-write memory of the virtual machine. Typically, these shared spaces are read-only so that everybody, you know, everything running can share a copy of a program or some data. They could be read-write, though, but they are useful for, like, a common kernel, a common nucleus, shared programs, things like that. And you do have some security control over who can use those if that's necessary. How do we do memory management in ZVM? Well, like I said, we used expanded storage as part of our paging hierarchy for when we have to move pages out of central memory or the main memory of the system. So we do that on demand. We use disk devices, DASD, to, of course, move pages out to, and we do that in blocks. How do we figure out what to take out of central or expanded storage? Well, in central storage, both of them use a least recently used, or an LRU, algorithm. We use something that's available in the hardware called reference bits to decide which pages are least, you know, it's been the longest time since they've been used. And in expanded storage, they have timestamps associated with each page, so we can just kind of look at the timestamps to see how old things are. In ZVM, we really consider paging activity, some degree of paging activity, to be normal. Certainly, you can make it so much paging activity that there's a performance problem, but ZVM is very good at paging if you set up the hierarchy correctly, and it's a normal thing. LPARs do not page. LPARs have dedicated storage, and so there is no paging and memory management to talk about for them. Linux certainly can page. It has different algorithms to do that. It doesn't really do swapping, although they're called swap disks. On smaller systems, paging uses I/O, and I/O may not be very fast, and so that's why it's traditionally considered bad. On a mainframe, if we're using simulated disks, paging I/O may not be bad. So here's a picture of ZVM memory virtualization. Over on the right, we have it says host real. And it says C store for central storage and X store for expanded storage above it, and then there's a paging disk. So that's what CP is managing over there. And then we have a virtual machine in the box with the red dashes. It has guest real and guest virtual. So the virtual machine thinks it has real memory. It's really virtual memory to CP, but it has real memory. It may swap, and it has a virtual address space to run a program in. I mean, you load a program into a virtual address space, that's guest virtual, and you run it. For a real processor to run a program, of course, the program and the data that it accesses must be in host real memory. So you'll notice that number one in the green box is really the only page in my guest virtual that's in host real memory. So maybe that's where my program is that's running. If it accesses data that, let's say, page 2A or 2B, they're in my guest real memory. You'll see in the middle there in the red boxes. So from my operating system point of view, it's ready to run. But for ZVM, ZVM has it in a couple different places. It has 2A on a paging disk, and it has 2B in expanded storage. So those need to be moved back into host real memory to actually access the data that would be on those. Likewise, for the other pages, 3 and 4, 3 is actually on the swap disk of the virtual machine, so the virtual machine operating system would have to move that page into guest real storage to use it. Number 4 is in guest real of the virtual machine, but ZVM has it on a paging disk, and it would have to move it into host real to use it. So it gives you a quick look at how memory can be managed, how pages can be spread all over the place, and what operations have to go on to be able to run programs and access data in ZVM. So let's move on to I/O resources here. So page 29 starts to talk about device management concepts. We have several different terms we use in ZVM for device management. The first one is, and I mentioned this one other time, dedicated or attached devices. So if you give a guest exclusive use of an entire real device, then there really isn't any management that ZVM has to do for that device because your guest has exclusive use of it. We're not trying to share it. If you have exclusive use of it, then you can do really anything you want with it. So that's dedicated or attached. Normally, though, we want to talk about sharing devices, and other ways to use them. So normally we more talk about virtualized devices. Virtualized devices are divided up maybe to get a slice of a real device so it can be shared by multiple virtual machines or used by multiple virtual machines, or maybe it's a device that you can time slice like a crypto processor and a crypto card, crypto device. So that's a virtualized device. ZVM can actually simulate devices too. So the real hardware that it's simulating probably isn't part of the real computer system that ZVM is running on, but ZVM can simulate it. One example of this, if you have two virtual machines that are attached by a channel-to-channel adapter, a CTCA, ZVM can simulate what a real CTCA looks like to an operating system on a real machine. It can simulate that so that each virtual machine and operating system in that virtual machine believes it has a channel-to-channel adapter that communicates with another virtual machine. We also have virtual disks. We also have virtual network devices, guest LANs. We have virtual spool devices. You might have seen on the VM directory entry, we actually have virtual card readers and card punches, which we haven't seen on real machines in quite a while. The reason we still have them, because ZVM simulates them, and they're very good for communicating between virtual machines and some other things, especially getting Linux going. We also have emulated devices in ZVM these days. And what that is we provide a device of one type that we maybe not have the real hardware for, using a real device of another type to actually provide the support. The emulated device we have these days is a fixed block architecture or FBA type disk devices. And the way ZVM provides those is it uses SCSI, FCP SCSI LUNs to actually provide those devices to your operating system. So your operating system thinks it has an FBA device using that architecture, but really the data is actually stored in a SCSI LUN, and ZVM is doing that emulation. There's a lot of terminology, of course, associated with devices too, so let's talk about some of those. RDEV, you may see that term in ZVM terms. That's a real device, so refers generally to a device address. A VDEV or maybe a virtual device is something a virtual machine uses. And then there's something called a UCB, and that stands for a unit control block, and that's really normally part of hardware definitions. But the reality is RDEV, UCB, and sometimes you see subchannel or device or adapter really are all the same, referring to the same thing, referring to an I/O device. So RDEV, UCB, subchannel, device, and adapter are really kind of the same thing. For device management, we have controls and limits we can place on those too, just like we could with processors and memory. There's share settings, there's some throttling, some limiting that can go on, channel priorities, and something called, the bottom one is MDC, stands for mini disk cache, and how that is used. And we'll talk a little about mini disk cache a few charts later on, so we'll get into that then. Let's talk about this chart, this little more busy chart about virtualization of disks and kind of what we're talking about there, how we, remember I said they're virtualized, disks can be virtualized devices, so how do we share a disk device? So if you look at the red letter A, which is on virtual device address 100, which is owned by the virtual machine Linux 1, it's a read-write disk. If you follow the red line down, you'll see that it ends at real device address 2B01, 2Baker01. That's the real device address. Well, this, as it says here, it's dedicated. It's a dedicated disk that's owned, attached basically to that Linux 1 machine at virtual address 100. So Linux 1 has full and exclusive use of that disk. You can do anything it wants with it. So we're not sharing that disk at all. But if we look at red letter B, which is virtual device address 100 on Linux 3, over on the right, you'll notice that follow the red line, it's mini disk 3. So device 2, Baker 02, is actually divided up into three mini disks, three slices, and we used that term earlier. So there are three mini disks. Each mini disk is just a portion of the real device. You just have a portion of that device which belongs to a certain virtual machine, and it can use it. So that's what Linux 3 is, and that's how we virtualize that 2Baker02 disk by slicing it into three mini disks. Likewise, you'll see that mini disk 2 is red letter C, which is address 200. That particular disk is shared basically by Linux 1 and Linux 2, two different virtual machines. It's shared read-only, meaning neither of those machines can write on it. In this case, the mini disk cache comes into play, and it's a high-speed in-memory disk cache, and that lets us avoid I.O. basically, and we can get better performance that way. And letter D is a temporary disk. That's address 101 on Linux 1. We can actually make a temporary disk allocation pool, and we can ask for temporary space on that, and we can create a mini disk that we can read and write to, but it's not a place to store permanent data because it's just a temporary disk. So that's some of the things about disk allocation. You can see some of the other uses there. SCSI and how it does emulation of FBA uses the same concepts, really. But each one of these things labeled in the bottom that say SCSI is a SCSI LUN, on the disk device. You'll notice that the one on the far right is divided up into three mini disks, A, B, and C, and you can see where they're used similarly like we did in the previous chart. We also have a temporary disk on the left. So, again, that's just a fixed box architecture version of the same one we saw earlier. We can dedicate a SCSI LUN to a Linux one, and that's done. That's not using the emulation. That's letting Linux speak in SCSI terms to the LUN, and it can do that. We can also use SCSI LUNs for paging, and ZVM won't boot through the emulation layer, but we'll do paging operations to that. So that's some of the terminology on SCSI. We also could, as I mentioned, have ways to put data in memory. You can use some of these simulated devices and this thing called mini disk cache to actually put data in memory and have faster access to it. So mentioned mini disk cache a couple times. This is actually a write-through cache. So there is no data integrity issues because any IOs we do to write to the disk are actually written, to the disk. We don't hold it in memory and write it later. So it's a write-through cache. It can be cached in either central or expanded storage, and it has really great performance. It uses something, an architecture capability called access registers, which lets us access the data directly. And there's lots of ways to tune how that's used, so you can make it work best for your system. We also have these virtual disks in storage, or VDisks. It's like a RAM disk, but it actually can be paged out of the system. It's not fixed in real memory, so we don't pay a penalty for having it in there. But it is volatile. It is temporary. If ZVM is restarted or the virtual machine is restarted, the contents may go away. It looks like a fixed block architecture disk. It can be shared also between virtual machines. And there's ways to tune those, of course. So finally, networking. What do we do with networks? Well, we can connect virtual machines to one another. We have different ways of doing this through a virtual network. A couple of the different types are called guest LANs or virtual switch guest LANs. We also have, as you can see in the middle, we can connect to virtual machines in another LPAR. This is something the hardware provides called a hypersocket. It's a virtualized I.O. device. It's provided by the hardware. We also can use the actual real hardware ports, OSA ports, and share them between LPARs, and so we can actually connect LPARs together through shared OSAs. As you'll see up with the guest LAN can be either the hypersockets type or the shared OSA type, if you will, the QDIO type. That's the same as OSAs use. And we can connect virtual machines to the physical network, because, of course, we need to do that eventually. We can either use dedicated OSA ports, or we can use something called a virtual switch. So the next page kind of gives you a better picture of what a virtual switch kind of looks like. At the bottom, it's basically what would look like if we used dedicated OSA ports, that kind of idea. Each Linux guest is connected in to a switch, and the switch is connected to the rest of the network, and that would take several OSA ports to do that. If we use a virtual switch, then the VM control program provides this virtual switch. I mean, it's very aptly named, network switch. Each Linux guest connects in to the virtual switch, and then the virtual switch is connected to the network through an OSA port. So that lets us not use as many OSA ports, allows us to use memory speed communications between the Linux guest, and really greatly simplifies our network design. So what can we do beyond virtualization? I mean, we've talked about just virtualizing the real machine, but we're certainly allowed in the architecture to extend what a virtual machine can do if it chooses to. So we have a lot of interfaces in CP. We certainly have a lot of commands to change and query and look at our virtual machine configuration. We have some pretty neat commands on debugging and tracing, which is on the next page that we'll get to. And these commands actually control CP itself and start and stop CP and work with real devices. And they're different privilege classes of what you as a user of CP are allowed to do. I think John, in the last presentation of the day, talks a lot more about privilege classes and CP commands. He also will talk more about this inter-virtual machine communication, which is how virtual machines can talk to each other, communicate with each other at memory speeds, and provide some very efficient communication. But that's something that ZVM provides that the real hardware or LPARs don't. There's a lot of system services that are part of CP. So you can get some kind of a connection to the hypervisor. My last chart shows a little picture of that, so we'll look at that then. And there's something called diagnose instructions. You hear, start talking about ZVM, you hear a lot about diagnose instructions. It's really a programming API so that an operating system can talk to CP or talk to the hypervisor. It's basically a procedure call kind of idea. And there are various operands. You know, it depends on what the diagnose instruction does and how you communicate with it. And the reason they're called diagnose instructions is because if you looked in the ZVM principles of operations, you'll find a real-life machine instruction called diagnose. The nice thing about it is it basically says what this command does, what this instruction does is model-dependent. It is unspecified what this does. And so they use that instruction because it's model-dependent and doesn't have a defined architectural use to be able to call CP to a procedure call to CP and pass operands. So that's why they're called diagnose instructions and not supervisor calls or hypervisor calls, because that's the instruction they use to do that. Like I said, we have an extensive debugging capability. We can trace virtual machines. We can display or store into virtual memory. This is used very extensively by developers of SystemZ operating systems to debug them and see what they're doing. There's a whole lot of documentation on the CP trace command, and you can see there some of the stuff you can do. And you would expect to be able to display or store virtual memory, so we certainly have all of that as well. We have other extensions, and this is just really the tip of the iceberg, basically. I'm on page 40, by the way, of what you can do with ZVM. We have something called a programmable operator. So if I ran a bunch of Linux machines or really any virtual machines, instead of having operators watching the consoles for messages, I can have a program do that. This programmable operator or prop program can actually watch and see what messages come out on the virtual consoles of various virtual machines. If I want, I can, when I see a message that I'm interested in, I can react to it, I can write a program. And then number three in this picture is maybe I initiate a hypervisor command or I initiate a command back to the Linux server. I certainly have all of those capabilities with ZVM. So it's a very robust in what you can do with automated type operations with your Linux systems. And this is the chart about talking about how we can interface with CP, in this case talking about performance and accounting data. CP has very extensive settings where it can keep track of what's going on within all of the virtual machines and within CP itself. We call that performance monitoring. Basically, CP keeps a bunch of counters, keeps track of what it's doing. It doesn't try to interpret it. It just keeps track of it. And what we can do is interface a virtual machine where it says collection there. That there's a virtual machine interfacing to that data, and it can store it on a disk. And also, while it's storing it on the disk, it can actually interpret it. So we can run something called Performance Toolkit which can actually interpret the data as it's coming out of CP and tell us, you know, how well our virtual machines are running, how well ZVM itself is running. So this is an example of how a virtual machine can interface directly into CP to get some data to find out how well things are working. Performance Toolkit has even web interfaces. There's also an extensive accounting facility within CP. It keeps track of consumption of resources by virtual machines. And this data comes out of CP into, you know, a collection point and can be processed, very similar to what we're looking at for performance data there. So that's been a really quick run-through of these charts. I'm pretty much out of time. There's a page of references on page 42, which you can look at later and see some more about CP. But now I'm to the point where I'd like to see if there are any, just have a few minutes for questions. So, John, if you could let us know how we do that.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, it's star 1 to signal for questions, and we'll pause just briefly to assemble the queue. And it appears at this time we have no questions.
Okay, I'm sure they're saving them for the next speakers because they're going to get into the more in-depth things. If you have questions later, I'd be happy to ask them, answer them. You have my email, or if you email Julie, she'd be also happy to pass them along.
Thank you, Bruce. John, why don't we go ahead and we'll take a 5-minute break and we'll start at the top of the hour.